Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome to our annual forecast show, where we give you our own views of the markets for 2019. Last week, we covered the consensus, and we looked at some of the out-of-the-box thinking on events that are outside of mainstream thinking. But before we begin, there's something really interesting that I want to draw your attention to. I want to summarize the consensus for 2019 as compared to 2020, because people are talking about a recession in 2020. So let's look at these numbers. For GDP, the consensus for 2019 is 2.6%. Now for 2020, 1.9%. Now CPI, the consensus 2019, 2.2%. And then 2020, 2.2%. Unemployment, 3.6%. 2020 is 3.6%. Fed funds rate goes from 3.05% in 2019 to 2.95%. The three-month T-bill, 3.19% to 3.16%. The two-year T-note, 3.12 to 3.15. And the 10-year T-note is 3.29 to 3.37. Now, do those numbers sound like a recession? But listen to this. When it comes to the stock market, Wall Street's bullish for 2019. High forecast is 29.75. The low forecast, 26.65. The average being 29.75 and the median 29.80. So in summary, I know it's a lot of numbers, but in summary, our expert soothsayers are expecting a slowdown in the economy, but no recession for the next 2 years. The Fed will raise the Fed funds rate 2 times in 2019. Interest rates will rise, but not invert. And when it comes to the stock market, nothing but gains this year. In fact, as little as 6 to 8% on the low side, 20% for the average. And if you look at the high side, that's at 30%. So there you have what the experts are forecasting for the economy and the markets. Now, they said the same thing last year, and it actually looked like they were right until we got to October. So the question is, will this year be the same? Now, let's move on to our own view of things. This year, as Jim and I have mentioned, our theme is fast and furious, time to buckle up.
Well, Chris, before we begin to what our own views are for this year, I want to begin by looking at what happened during the last quarter of the year. As John Kosar and I talked about in the first hour, we talked about, for example, what happened in the oil market and the stock market. So as we entered the last quarter of the year, economic momentum and earnings growth were in high gear. What followed has much to do with algo trading, indexing, and the markets being run by machines, not humans. In my opinion, the fundamentals and technicals basically decoupled, leading to the reversal of fortunes we saw in just about every asset class. Now, the result was you saw losses across a broad category of assets. I don't care where you looked, if you looked at stocks, to bonds, and to commodities. Now, let me give you an example of what I mean by technicals divorcing from the reality of fundamentals. And the best example I can give you is what we talked about with our experts this week is the oil markets. We began the year with oil prices in an upswing as OPEC cuts tightened the markets and got rid of the oil glut. By summer, the price began to accelerate into early fall as the markets became fearful of an Iranian oil coming off the markets, along with the drop in Venezuelan oil production. As we covered in our show called What the Hell Just Happened, the sell-off was triggered by the waivers granted by the president, a surge in U.S. shale production, and fears of a global slowdown. So given the run-up in the fall to $77 in WTI and $85 on Brent, settling back to the $65-$75 price would have made sense, because a lot of the movement we saw towards the end was this whole idea that given the first week in November, several million barrels of oil were going to come off the market as sanctions were put into place against Iran. Well, we all know what happened. On November 5th, the sanctions didn't go in effect. The president granted waivers, and of course, the markets began to sell off. So you would have expected to see oil drift back in the low 60s for WTI, maybe high 60s, low 70s for Brent. The run-up was based, as I mentioned, the fears of a drop-off of Iranian exports. But that is not what happened. We went, but here's the important point. We went from a peak to a low of $42 on December 4th. That was a drop of 45% in just 2 months. In other words, we went from a bull to a bear market, characterized as a loss of 20% in just a month, then accelerated to a loss of 45% in another month, an official bear market. Now, since the lows that were set in place the day before Christmas, oil prices are up 25% in what is now called a new bull market. So in the course of just 2 months, Chris, we went from record highs in a bull market to a steep bear market to another bull market with prices up 25% all in the period of 2 months. Does anyone believe this is rational behavior? It isn't. It's machines, not humans, running the markets. And it's going to happen again because algo trading permeates all asset classes, again, along with three other FSN themes we'll talk about, from passive index, a bubble, to financial concentration and liquidity risk, which are going to play a very important role this year. The markets are set to repeat much of the volatility in wide swings that we saw in 2018 could be repeated this year.
Well, and I want to ask you something about that. With us talking and opening the show today about consensus for 2019 and 2020, I've heard you say, Jim, on previous shows that with the stimulus package, that there's more of that coming this year. So you're expecting 2019 to really look golden. So you'd think that, oh, well, then 2020 is when things are going to start sort of evening out or correcting. But again, the consensus shows that 2020 still has strong numbers. So with what we saw happen last year during the first week of February and at the end of the year, sounds like you expect similar things to happen again, or maybe follow a similar pattern this year.
And I do, because, you know, we talk about the stimulus. Last January, they passed a bill in addition to the tax cuts that were passed at the end of 2017, which were $1.5 trillion, they passed an additional spending program of $300 billion. Now, the government's fiscal year ends in September. So there's still, Chris, about another quarter of a trillion dollars of stimulus that will play out in the first part of the year and leading into the third quarter. But by September, all of that stimulus will have been spent. So I do expect greater volatility, and that volatility is going to be more pronounced. So hence, our theme this year is fast and furious. Think of what happened to oil in a short period of time last year. Think of what happened to stocks, not only in October, but the acceleration into December, as well as what happened in the first week of February of last year. So hence our theme this year of fast and furious. Things always tend to get more volatile when you approach the end of a Fed rate raising cycle. Think of going back to 2007. We weren't in a recession. We weren't in a bear market yet, but we were seeing a lot of volatility in the market. We had problems with Bear Stearns. The markets peaked later on in the fall, and by December of 2017, we were in a recession. Now, on the surface, it may appear the economy looks pretty good right now with these economic numbers, the job numbers, as you just pointed out. We're at the lowest unemployment level that we've been in probably over four decades. But the unemployment rate is a lagging indicator. So the economy, as these forecasts show, are already beginning to slow down, not just here in the U.S., but abroad. The OECD just issued a report saying global growth has peaked. And this week, the World Bank just issued a report in its annual assessment of global prospects. It is issuing a warning of increased risk on what it calls darkening skies for the global economy.
Given that you expect volatility to increase, what about the projections for the market? I kind of still fixated on this 2019-2020 projection. Do you think, Jim, it would be like last year where we hit the annual forecast targets for the year, well, during the first month, only to give it all back in a single week, might I add, and also like last November and December? Would you say it's similar to what happened to the price of oil?
You know, Chris, I think it will be, but I think it's going to be more volatile with steeper movements in markets. Remember, the Fed is withdrawing liquidity from the markets to the tune of $50 billion a month. That's $600 billion a year. And that's why the market sold off after the December FOMC meeting, because basically Powell said, we have no intention of cutting back on QT. We're proceeding as planned. And then you saw the rally as the Fed kind of softened that in speeches at the beginning of this year. So just look at the price of oil. We're now up over 25%, a new bull market, in just a few weeks. And as last week's technician Craig Johnson, I think we're going to see these markets move in a wide trading range. We could be hitting the upper limits of the street forecast and then just turn around and give back gains very quickly. The way to think of rising markets are to think in terms of an escalator. The way to think about corrections is a falling elevator. So we could see the S&P 500 swing from 2,500, where we ended up last year, to some of the highs that some of these forecasters are projecting of 2,900, a range close to the average of what all forecasts are for the year. So, and a lot will depend on whether some of the wild cards and risks that we'll be talking about are resolved, from anything from trade issue to clarity on Fed policy, maybe the Fed going on pause, and basically, even as some forecasters are saying, that they don't even raise at all this year.
So, Jim, it looks like based on that, that you do expect that volatility is here to stay, and that is a view shared by others on Wall Street.
Stock market volatility is the new normal. But let's not forget, volatility is the old normal, too. Yes, 2018 saw the return of mad market swings on five different days. The Dow moved 1,000 points or more. Moves that big have only happened 8 times in history. So the fact that 5 of them occurred last year is significant. But the market is not more volatile than ever before. Investors just don't remember the roller coaster ride because for a decade, stocks pretty much just went steadily higher. In fact, spikes in volatility have always been a part of Wall Street's landscape. Just look at this chart going back to 1928. So how long will the current wave of volatility last? Well, probably for a while. Uncertainty about the global economy, particularly in Europe and China, has rattled investors. Trade tensions between the U.S. and China have yet to be resolved. And investors are worried about interest rates. If the Fed raises rates too quickly, it could slow the economy too much, even trigger a recession. For years, investors would buy every dip. Now they seem to sell every rally. So expect more volatility. After a long break, it's back with a vengeance, and it's likely here to stay.
Jim, do you have a year-end target for the stock market? Or just to make things easier on you, where do you think the stock market will end up for the year? Do you think it'll be up, down, flat? Do you think we'll be sipping pina coladas or jumping out the window?
Maybe doing both. You could be holding on to your pina colada as you go out the window. So, you know, Chris, one of the things, and some of the experts we've had on the program are making reference, it's really difficult to predict markets and it's a perilous task at the best of times, and it's far more difficult in the final stages of a Fed rate raising cycle. So if you look at how forecasts are made, generally at the beginning of the year, you know, you've got the top 50 firms, they'll come out with what their S&P targets are for the year. What the analysts do is they start out with an estimate of what they think S&P 500 earnings are, and then they assign a PE multiple to those earnings, and they come up with that number. Now, the multiple is either above or below the average based on the optimism or, in some cases, pessimism of the strategist or the analyst. If the worries I identified are resolved, it could be a very good year in the end with positive returns. If they aren't, then we're going to be like last year with those violent upswings or downswings depending on the news cycle, with movements exaggerated on the up and the downside due to these algo-driven markets and what I call shrinking liquidity. So, Chris, a lot of it is going to depend, just like it was last year, what the Fed's going to do, what's going to happen with the trade war, and, you know, a lot of these other anxieties, and not to mention the political discord that we're already seeing at the beginning of the year as we have a change with the Democrats now controlling the House.
Well, it's interesting your take on the volatility, Jim, and how you see that increasing over the next year. But first, let's discuss the risks that you see for the year. And then what I'd like to do is just move on to the topics of why you think volatility will be more elevated this year.
You know, when it comes down to risk, I see three main risks in that analyst. She made reference to two of them. And I also see two minor risks. But let's talk about the big ones. The one big one at the top of the list is a policy mistake by the Fed. They might raise interest rates too much. In fact, one Fed governor already came out that if the Fed goes any further with interest rates, they risk pushing the economy into a recession. Risk number two, escalation of the trade war between the U.S. and China, In risk number three, political discord, Democrats investigate versus legislate. Two other ones I want to point out, we'll probably cover these on future shows, oil spikes, which I expect to see this year, and cyber attack on infrastructure. But I would say the three big ones are the Fed, the trade war, and political discord.
I'm really intrigued by those three, particularly the third with what's happening with the shutdown right now. In fact, I'm just intrigued by how the market doesn't seem to be very spooked with this shutdown having extended as long as it has. But would you mind expounding on the three ones in general, Jim?
Well, let's take Fed. Let's say the Fed making a policy mistake. You know, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but you take a look at every single recession has been preceded by a Fed rate hike. These guys have a track record of crash landing the airplane, which is what Fed Governor Bullard was saying. Hey, if we go forward, we run the risk of pushing the economy into a recession. It's already slowing down. It slowed down in the third quarter, slowed down in the fourth quarter. It's expected to slow down in the first part of this year. And that's reflected in a lot of the consensus forecast. The markets have reacted, for example, favorably to comments made last week by the Fed. And then, of course, there was an economic forum in Washington, D.C. this week where the Fed chairman was sounding more dovish. And he emphasized they would practice patience. They're looking more at weakening economic data. Hey, thank you. And then hinting they could maybe throttle back on QT. I want to play a few of those clips, if you would.
Financial markets have been sending different signals of concern about downside risks, about slowing global growth, particularly related to China, about ongoing trade negotiations, about what maybe let's call general policy uncertainty coming out of Washington, and among other factors. So, you do have this difference between, on the one hand, strong data and some tension between financial markets that are signaling concern and downside risks. And the question is, with those contrasting sets of factors, how should we think about the outlook and how should we think about monetary policy going forward? Now, when we get conflicting signals, as is not infrequently the case, policy is very much about risk management. And I'll offer a couple of thoughts on that to wrap up. First, as always, there is no preset path for policy. And particularly with the muted inflation readings that we've seen coming in, we will be patient as we watch to see how the economy evolves. But we're always prepared to shift the stance of policy and to shift it significantly if necessary in order to promote our statutory goals of maximum employment and stable prices. And I'd actually like to point to a recent example when the committee did just that in early 2016. And I mentioned this in this December press conference in passing. As many of you will recall, in December 2015, when we lifted off from the zero lower bound, the median FOMC participant expected 4 rate increases for 2016. But very early in the year, in 2016, financial conditions tightened quite sharply. And under Janet's leadership, the committee nimbly, and I would say flexibly, adjusted our expected rate path. We did eventually raise rates a full year later in December 2016. Meanwhile, the economy weathered a soft patch in the first half of 2016 and then got back on track, and gradual policy normalization resumed. Now, no one knows whether this year will be like 2016. But what I do know is that we will be prepared to adjust policy quickly and flexibly and to use all of our tools to support the economy, should that be appropriate, to keep the expansion on track, to keep the labor market strong, and to keep inflation near 2%.
So there you have, Chris, the Fed chairman kind of reassuring the market, hey, we hear you. We see the volatility. We see the trade tensions. We see the political discord, kind of dialing back from where they were in September when they were saying, hey, we're far from neutral, in December when he said, nope, we're going to cruise right ahead on the QT. So that was a lot more dovish than what we were hearing from the Fed and the chairman himself in the third and fourth quarter. Now, on the dovish side of things at the Fed, 3 of the 4 new voting members of the FOMC have all signaled, they've all, I call it, Chris, the open mouth committee, because they've been all out there saying things. They're all saying they are willing to take some time to gain greater clarity about the outlook before doing anything with monetary policy. But once again, in the words of St. Louis Fed Governor James Bullard, he warned the Fed risks pushing the economy into a recession if it raises rates further. Now, the recent comments by Powell and other governors has lowered the probabilities in the futures market. The futures market now has a 75% probability that the Fed either holds rates steady this year or ends up cutting them. That is a big sea change in the last 30 days. So for now, it looks like they remain on pause with the futures market predicting low probabilities of a rate hike in the first half of the year. In fact, I was looking at the futures projections at each FOMC meeting. You actually don't get any kind of probability increase until you get to about June. The probabilities are about 18% for a hike in June. It stays at 18%, rises to 20% in September, then begins to decline in the final two Fed FOMC meetings for the year. So that is the story right now. It may very well change by the summer if my rising oil price thesis plays out, which is a topic probably for another show. So once again, like last year, 2019 could be a two-half story, something different in the first half, something different in the second half, with both having different outcomes.
And Jim, let's do talk about the other two big ones that you mentioned, the China trade war and political discord. You know, just last night, I was talking with someone whose family is affected by the shutdown. They don't have a paycheck today. And we got into quite a lengthy conversation about how that directly impacts them. I mean, we can watch the news, read the paper, all that, but it just got so real for me. And I imagine there's quite a number of our listeners who are also directly impacted by the shutdown. So I'd like to talk about how political discord and China, the China trade war, if you can address both of those as well.
Let's start with the trade war. I believe the trade war story will get resolved with both parties, especially the president feeling, or at least walking away from the table, feeling like he got something. In fact, the Chinese have to walk away from the table feeling like, hey, they did a give in entirely to Trump. That resolution, by the way, has oil implications if China starts buying U.S. wheat crude again. Their lack of buying was one of the contributing factors to our inventory build. Now, the trade war is starting to impact companies from rising material costs. We're seeing that in the PMIs to shrinking sales. Think of Apple's lowering its fourth quarter guidance on revenues, which helped ignite a steep sell-off in stocks, including Apple itself. So I expect the trade war issue to get resolved, which will be a positive for the markets, and you could see a strong rally if that happens. The final wild card political discord is playing out, I'm afraid, negatively from the start. Now, we are in week 3 and 4 of a government shutdown. And I think the thing that people find so frustrating, the government is, its fiscal budget this year will be greater than $4.4 trillion, and we're shutting down the government over a wall and $5 billion. Chris, that's like arguing over a seat in a 50,000-seat football stadium. So it looks like political tensions and discord are what's in store this year and next. And we are just, don't forget, we're in the start of a presidential election cycle. I don't believe we're going to see any form of cooperation. There's a lot of news stories coming out this week. There's proposals to raise personal income taxes to 70%, corporate tax rates back to 30%, a $1 trillion carbon tax, new regulations, investigations, talks of impeachment. So I don't think compromise, peace, and harmony are in the cards this year in Washington, which could create new uncertainties for the markets. Now, they are working on a resolution, Chris, for those individuals that have gone without a paycheck, that they will get their back pay. The markets are probably more sanguine about this because they know people are going to get their Social Security checks. Interest on the debt is going to get paid. Those things will go on, but it is disheartening to see something go on like this and to just argue over something like $5 billion when you're spending over $4.4 trillion.
Yeah, it is impacting a lot of folks. I appreciate you addressing that, Jim, and addressing the risks in general. And I'd like to get back, speaking of risks, I'd like to get back to your theme of volatility to discuss what you think is driving it and also just the much broader picture of where you think things are heading.
You know, I want to come back to three themes we began to articulate in 2017. Passive indexing, shrinking liquidity, and financial concentration all played a role in 2018, exasperated by algo trading. Now, the markets have become, I think anybody that we have on the show admits, more difficult to anticipate over the last few years as new technologies have evolved and the traditional active managers and human judgment has been replaced by computerized models or machines. HFT is wreaking havoc on the markets and making old-fashioned, what I call fundamental analysis and common sense, quite honestly, obsolete. I mean, if you take a look at what happened in February of last year, the oil markets in the final months of the year, and the stock market in this, let's say, December, is probably just the beginning. We saw big drawdowns in stocks despite very little fundamental economic news. And here's a key point, making last December the worst December since the Depression year of 1931. In fact, in words of one of the most well-known successful fund managers, Stanley Druckenmiller, he worked with George Soros. He's a multi-billionaire who's averaged 20% returns annually when he was running a hedge fund. And as he said, these algos have taken all the rhythm out of the markets and have become confusing to me. Chris, let's go to that clip of his hour-long interview where he made reference to how it's altered what is happening in the markets.
Someone said the other day, you've been very critical of these algos. And I said, well, I'm not critical of the algos. They just made my life very inconvenient. It's not that they're doing anything wrong. So what I meant by that, Eric, is a big part of my process, and you've already kind of heard it throughout the interview, is taking signals from markets. I've always believed markets are smarter than I am. They send out a message, and that if I listen to them properly, no matter how powerful my thesis, if they're screaming something else, it's telling me you've got to reevaluate, and you go back to it, and it's still all right, fine, but you got to be open-minded. About, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, combination of central banks canceling the signals, but maybe more importantly, the algos coming in with very, very sophisticated models based on historical events and maybe stuff they're picking up on the internet about who's shopping or this kind of stuff, and also on standard deviation away from price, have come up with their own methodology of how to predict price movements and how to behave. Well, I grew up with someone fundamentally likes the security, and they buy it from somebody who fundamentally doesn't like security. And somehow the invisible hand spit out a very good answer, and it was predictive over time. And I also learned that things would change, and when the trends started to go up, that's when I'm supposed to plow in. Well, the algos, machines trading, they tend to have different motivations. Like, they're not nearly as momentum-oriented, and just when the trend may look like it's going up, it may be just some algo who's got some standard deviation or something going on. And it has severely inhibited my ability to read the signals.
There you have, Chris, probably one of the most successful hedge fund managers on the planet, saying that, you know, his life has been made more difficult. It's harder to read where the market's going. In fact, there was a story in the Financial Times this week and a study done by JP Morgan. Only about 10% of U.S. equity trading is now done by traditional investors. The first clue that markets had changed was what we saw in the flash crash of 2010, where in just 36 minutes, the S&P 500 crashed 8% and then rebounded back to where it started. February of last year was another example of what I'm calling fast and furious, the new norm. Things aren't done in several years, months, or weeks. They could be done in minutes, a day, or even a week. Think of a fast descending elevator, not an escalator on the way down. Now, the markets and the way they function, as Druckenmiller was talking about, have changed dramatically. Quants and HFTs account for over half of all U.S. equity trading. Now, you throw in index funds, and we have what I call mindless investing that at times can turn on a dime, become divorced from fundamentals, which is making these markets more difficult to navigate. And what makes this, I guess, more dangerous is these players can intersect at the same time during periods of market stress. Now, the problem with the markets being dominated by HFTs is that they have far less capital than the major banks. They cannot withstand any major move or loss. So when things get bumpy or mayhem breaks out in the markets, they can withdraw liquidity rapidly, which removes a floor underneath market prices. I mean, they have no choice. What they do is they withdraw from battle, lick their wounds, and hope to live and fight another day. Now, the result is what we're seeing. A modest amount of selling can have an outsized impact on asset prices, as we saw, for example, during the month of December. And according to that same study, J.P. Morgan said S&P 500 futures markets shrunk last month, so any kind of small move was magnified by the lack of liquidity. So when liquidity remains low, market volatility increases. And we have to deal with the reality that financial markets are run by machines and automated, and the problems arise when markets are this technologically complex and interconnected. You can get an unforeseen event that crashes the financial system, as what nearly happened in 2008 with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Or, you know, a simple example is where we were last year. We start out the year week after week, hitting record after record. In fact, I think in the fourth week of January, we already hit the highs for the year. And then one Friday, we got an unemployment report with rising wages higher than expected, and it started the dominoes falling. So in a one-week period of time, we essentially gave back all the year's gains.
Should you buy and hold at market tops? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and to minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
You know, I was listening to your interview, Jim, with John Kosar at the top of the hour, the first hour. And even though there's been what I think a lot of folks would think of as some confusion, the volatility, what's going on here in 2019, John was very clear. I felt like really just provided a great interview talking about key levels for stocks and gold in that first hour. But Jim, as you interviewed him, what is your take as to where we go from here?
You know, once again, I think those technical levels John mentioned need to hold. However, the machines are telling investors, short everything. Trend-following investment strategies have gone from bullish to bearish to a degree, Chris, I have not seen in a decade. And according to an analysis of algorithms that buy, sell, or have buy-sell programs based on asset price momentum, funds that use this strategy for trading markets are believed to have gone from holding net long positions, meaning they think the markets are going up, betting on prices will rise in all asset classes from stocks, bonds, currencies to commodities. Right now, they are net short every asset class but bonds for 2019. And even then, their bets on bonds is bearish if you think about reflecting a flight to safety. So at the moment, trend traders are at odds with these Wall Street analysts' expectations for the market, and especially those who believe the sell-off was overdone. If you take a look at a lot of the forecasts for the year, we ended the year at 2,500. They're saying, look, earnings are still going up, the economy's still growing, earnings should go up, so therefore, we expect that the sell-off that we saw last year was way overplayed. Therefore, this year was the first year we couldn't even find one bear in every one of those forecasts. Even on the low side at 26.65, that implies a 6-8% return. So as we covered in last week's consensus program, not one strategist expects a down year for the market. The gist of what we see is that it's going to be a tough environment, which is why I guess right now we, at least for our own firm and clients, are defensive.
Well, and the reason why I mentioned this feeling of uncertainty with the volatility is that even though the economy is still growing, and even though we have unemployment at record lows and corporate profits are forecast to be up double digits, we're seeing the markets just it's like they're acting really nervously. So it's like they're anticipating something bad is going to happen in the future. And I'd mentioned, Jim, even though the stimulus package is going to have a positive impact, is there a crisis that unfolds here? I mean, if so, where do you think that's likely to emerge?
You know, we've mentioned this in past programs, and we're watching this very closely. We've commented throughout the year. Our view is the risk lies within the corporate bond sector. Corporate debt is up nearly 60% in this expansion. And I might add, a good amount of that debt is BBB rated. That is only one step above junk bond status. So if you look at the corporate bond market, which is just mushroomed in this decade, one-third is junk, one-third is BBB. So basically, two-thirds of the corporate bond market is high risk, and only one-third is investment grade. Now, the real crisis begins when the economy weakens and the economy heads into a recession. What do you think is going to happen to those BBB-rated bonds? They're probably going to get downgraded into, let's say, junk bond status. What's that going to do? It's going to trigger a wave of selling in bond funds and bond ETFs. The BBB market has exploded, just to give you an idea, from $750 billion in 2007 to today, it's $2.7 trillion as investors and funds went after yield. What makes this scenario interesting, at least from our view, the composition of the bond market has changed during this recovery. In the past, high-yield, low-quality bonds were sold to insurance companies, pension plans, were mainly the preserve of institutional investors. If you look at what's happened in this decade, as the Fed kept interest rates at zero, and after the Great Recession and bear market, what we saw is retail investors, after going through two bear markets, they plowed into bond funds and bond ETFs in search of yield. So there are a lot of bond funds and a lot of bond ETFs that are sitting on low quality and, more importantly, illiquid bonds. In the bond sell-off last month, for example, Bloomberg reported that a lot of these funds were forced to sell their high-quality liquid bonds in order to meet investor liquidations, which means they're sitting on the low-quality, less liquid stuff. If we get another downdraft in bonds, or if, let's say, credit spreads widen as a result of, let's say, a slowing economy or a deteriorating economy, as I expect, that could bring about losses in more liquidations. The other issue is due to regulations that were passed as a result of the financial crisis with Dodd-Frank, basically forcing banks and bond dealers to reduce their bond inventories. So what does that mean? So if you look at where we were a decade ago, bond ETFs were somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 billion. Dealer inventories were in the neighborhood of $260 to $300 billion. So they're almost 7 to 10 times larger than the bond market itself. So there was plenty of liquidity in the bond market. Now, take a look at where we are today. That picture has reversed. Inventories are between $30 and $40 billion against bond ETFs of $300 billion. So if in the event of a severe market sell-off, similar to kind of what we saw go on in the month of December, liquidity is diminished as bond dealers' ability to, let's say, provide liquidity has fallen by close to 80%. So at least in our opinion, the epicenter of the next financial crisis lies within our corporate bond markets. In the words of Warren Buffett, you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out. Could it be GE, which has outstanding corporate debt that is equal to almost 10% of the junk bond market? What happens if they get a debt downgrade into all that debt owned by bond funds and ETFs? They're going to be forced to sell. The Financial Times, I found it interesting this week, the Financial Times did a piece this week talking about a guy by the name of Steve Eisman. Now, if you're not familiar with Steve Eisman, he was the famous individual in Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, in the movie about the book. He sees corporate bonds as another menace that's hovering over the financial markets. And what he's referring to is what we've been talking about, is this massive amount of bonds that has been issued in the BBB area, which is one step above junk bond rating. Now, he makes reference to a point we made back in 2017 about the shrinkage in dealer trading inventories as banks attempt to comply with these new rules on capital and liquidity. So if you ask me, where's the next crisis likely to emerge? Where's the next big wheel that is likely to float up dead on the shores? The epicenter is likely to be the corporate bond center. I don't think it's going to be the banking sector, which is better capitalized and has been more restricted. And it is more likely, as I mentioned in this corporate bond, it'll be exaggerated as a result of liquidity, which can force, let's put it this way, when you're trying to sell somebody and there's nobody out there as a market maker or a dealer willing to take the other side of the trade, what happens is the asset keeps falling until somebody somewhere that has some kind of fundamental knowledge of what's going on with the bonds or the assets steps in and says, you know what, that kind of a price, I'm a buyer. So that's what happens. So these selling episodes could be a lot steeper and result in losses on these funds who hold these bonds. At least that's according to Eisman. And I would agree with them.
Well, that definitely explains our theme for the year, Fast and Furious Time to Buckle Up. And I appreciate you going into quite a bit of detail explaining the volatility. And it is also, Jim, it's a view shared by Variant Perception's Simon White. He was recently interviewed by Chris Sheridan this week on Financial Sense FSN Insider.
If you look at core CPI, although we may see some further consolidation in the shorter term, and I mean the next 3 to 6 months, the net move over 2019 should be higher. So, you know, towards the probably second half or end of the first half of this year, we should start to see core rise. What does this mean for the Fed today? Well, likely I could see this as having an extended pause. But then I could see inflation begin to start picking up again, as it does tend to do very late in the cycle. And then the Fed will have to resume their hiking.
So given these cheerful possibilities, Jim, what do you think investors should be doing right now?
You know, as I've mentioned, we are defensively positioned right now, as I believe this will be a very volatile year with different outcomes in the first half and the second half. I could see inflation, as Variant Perception was making reference there, remaining muted in the first half of the year, rising and escalating in the second half, which would mean we could likely see the Fed remain on pause probably the first 6 months of the year. But if inflation starts to pick up as we get closer to year end, watch for the language to change by the Fed and watch the impact that will have on markets. So, you know, what should investors do? I think, Chris, this really depends on what stage of life you're in. I mean, if you are young, just starting out your career and you're putting money each month into, let's say, your 401k program, quite honestly, I wouldn't do anything. If a recession, a bear market arrives, you're going to be dollar cost averaging each month. So as share prices fall, you're going to be buying more shares with your monthly contributions. So really, if you're a young person, what really matters more to you is in 30, 40 years from now is how many shares you're going to own. Quite honestly, you're not going to care about anything we are talking about here at the moment. Now, if you own high quality, let's say blue chip dividend paying stocks with a history of paying dividends and raising those dividends every year, you need the income, stay the course, hold on, get your dividends, enjoy the annual increases. Because there's one thing I'm going to guarantee you, and it's this. If you have capital gains, and let's say you have large capital gains, you could face a 37% bear market and what I call an income tax correction on those gains. Depending on your tax bracket, you could end up paying 24% in capital gains tax at the federal level. If you happen to live in our high-tax state of California, you could end up paying the state of California 13.3% to the state of California. And this was an issue I raised with famed technician Ralph Ancampora last fall when I asked him. I said, Ralph, what do you do if you're a retired individual or you're a pension fund and you're relying on that income every year, those dividends to come in to pay your bills, you like the dividend increases? What do you do? I mean, you're a technician. Let's play that clip, and I think this will surprise you.
I got to tell you something very personal. My lovely wife, Rosemary, was a financial advisor, and her whole thing was retirement. I mean, Rosemary retired several years ago due to illness. If not, she'd still be doing it because she loved it. And her clients called and called me and said, oh, my God, we're going to miss Rosemary. She's been so great to us. What she did is she tied everybody up, including us, in these high-yielding situations. And I remember in 2007, 2008, when that market started rolling over, I went down to Rosemary. I said, honey, I think we've got to start selling this stuff. She said, please, we're in there for the long term. You told me that same story, Ralph, in 2000. And we went down with the market and went up with the market. If you're in those high-yielding stocks, as you said, Coca-Cola or telephone, I don't know. We have more. And we just ride them out. And, you know, it kills me as a technician. You know, I see these breakdowns and tops and, you know, I'm looking, running for the hills. And her argument is, you know, you got to time it correctly getting out, and then you got to time it correctly getting in, and then you're paying taxes on your profits. And, you know, from a long-term investment point of view, people, you know, in the 60s and 70s, I'm 77 years old, and now we don't mess with anything. Oh, we have a few dollars. We'll play around with some crazy stuff. But by and large, the majority of our money is exactly what you described. And I'm saying this to everyone. This is personally what we've done. And thank God Rosemary was adamant about it and didn't listen to me turning the account. So, so I'm, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to buy the family farm. And if not, I think I'd be a cow on the farm.
So there you have probably one of the legendary technicians on Wall Street basically saying, you know what, when it comes to managing money, I go with my wife's advice. We buy good quality, high dividend paying stocks. We hold them, and we hold them for the long run if they go down. And this is something, Chris, I think that is a misperception by investors. If I own, I don't know, Coca-Cola, Exxon, Procter & Gamble, high quality blue chip company, yes, the price may go down. And people perceive the drop in price with the change in their income. That's not the case. Your income doesn't change. And if you own high quality blue chips, as Ralph was talking about what his wife bought in their portfolio, guess what? Those dividends go up. And you could see this. I mean, if you own Coca-Cola in 2007, 2008, and 2009, you probably lost about a third of your value in terms of this stock price falling. But guess what? In 2007, your income went up 7%. 2008, it went up another 7%. And 2009, it went up another 7 or 8%. And by the end of 2009, it was right back up to 30 again. So during the downturn, your income went up over 25%. And so I've owned energy stocks for several decades now. These are blue chip stocks. They pay dividends. And every single year, I love the fact that I get a pay increase. They all increase. And there's periods like the month of October, November, and December, and you look, you don't like seeing the price. But I know these companies. I've owned them for decades. And I know that, number one, my dividend isn't going to change. And number two, it's more likely to go up. Those are the things in my portfolio that I just don't touch, just like Rosemary and Ralph. And these are companies, because I do know if I sell them, I am going to take a bear market correction, and it's going to be called taxes, and it's going to be 37%. If you take a look at what I'm doing right now, I'm buying gold, silver, and I have a liquid position in short-term sovereign debt, as do my clients. I still remain bullish on energy, and we're going to talk about the implications of that in upcoming programs, and I'm turning bullish on gold. We're going to be covering these in the big picture in the months ahead. But you know what? It's like Rosemary's advice to Ralph. Ralph, if you sell them, you got to determine the right time to sell. You got to determine the right time to buy. And then on top of that, you're going to end up paying taxes. So it really depends on who you are, your risk tolerance, your need for income, which we've been talking and will be talking a lot about in lifetime income, especially for those of you getting ready to retire or nearing retirement, and you're worried about how am I going to handle my income needs as I age. So it really depends on so many factors. But, you know, once again, being diversified, owning quality, having some liquidity is the advice I would give, and being somewhat defensive.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and summarize then, Jim. It sounds like the forecast for this year that volatility will accelerate. And by the way, that is a trend that has been in place since last year. We've had wild rides both on the upside and the downside. Overall, you are defensively positioned for both yourself and your clients. You expect this to be another volatile year. So listeners, it is time to indeed fasten the seatbelts and buckle up. And I do also want to alert our listeners to past shows that we've done in 2017, where Jim did articulate a risk thesis on passive index bubble, but also financial concentration and shrinking liquidity. And what we'll do to make this easy for you, we'll post a link to those past shows on our website, financialsense.com. Click on those. You'll see where we've gone into depth on these risks, which are currently playing out today.
Now, I want to point out, unlike, let's say, the convulsions that we saw in the markets in late 2015 and early 2016, Chris, the yields on safe investments are considerably higher today, where you can get anywhere from 3 to 6% in relatively safe investments. So, you know, when you think about it, not a bad way to position yourself defensively without sacrificing returns.
So, Jim, any final thoughts as we close?
Yeah, I think this would pretty much sum up in terms of what we've been talking about here for pretty much the last couple of years in this Fed rate raising cycle. We are now in the final stages of a Fed rate raising cycle. The Fed finds itself in uncharted territory, trying to find a balance between its conflicting goals. Now, if you take a look at the financial crisis, it was successful in lifting the economy out of the last crisis. That job is now complete. The next challenge for the Fed policy going forward is to prevent the next, albeit different, crisis, which has just begun.
Well, that does conclude our annual forecast series for 2019. Next week, there will be some important changes to the broadcast, so please do stay tuned.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.